Let's get started here. So I put together this outline of what we can, just an overview of the Masechta. So the first thing I want to point out is that it's a very interesting connection to Bava Kamma. So as Yair could tell us, what's the division of the Masechta? The three Bavas, one Masechta, three Masechtas?
So it seems like originally there were one Masechta. You have the three Bavas putting together the Masechta, one Masechta, and the Zikir. They're still being together and you're counting maybe the Tosefta, but I'm not sure. And the way the Bavas are printed, you have down the three Bavas that are common.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. You know, divided, you know, by content, but also by number of properties.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting question. What's the relationship between the stuff that we're going to see this year in Bar Mitzvah and the more pure Nezikin stuff that appears in Bava Kamma? So last year's Bava Kamma stuff is pure Nezikin, what we'll call just Torah law. This year, especially from Masilcha Rasa'unim and onwards, which is what we're going to focus on, is more accurately characterized as contract law. These are liabilities that arise under special relationships. There's some antecedent relationship between the parties, there's a contract, there's an agreement, and the question is what liabilities arise under the That's really different from most of what we've seen last year in Bava Kamma. Because what's happening in Bava Kamma? What's the primary question? Or what's the topic discussed in Bava Kamma?
Torahs.
Yeah, and what are torahs?
Damages.
So, this year we'll talk about damages also, right? I hire you, you don't show up, I suffer damage because of that. So this is also a kind of damage.
Or more of like a loss.
So you want to say this year is more about losses of potential gains? That's not true for all of the things we'll see.
There's like Dabra Abba,
the pull doesn't show up and I suffer an irrecoverable loss because of his failure to abide by the agreement. So what's the difference in the Bava Kamma stuff and that Bava Mitzvah stuff?
Or potential for something like physical to actually be lost.
In which case?
Main primary damage is always it's always possible to have an actual. So here it's like monetary, I guess it's like more like a.
So I don't think the primary distinction between the Bava Kamma stuff and the Bava Mitzvah stuff is between Bava Kamma physical and Bava Mitzvah more abstract or economic. Anybody have Mitani, you have a suggestion?
Yeah, I'm thinking out loud, but I would say that I feel last year was a lot more. We spoke a lot about one of the overlapping areas that we saw last year that will continue this year is the relationship between multiple parties. In the sense that last year we spoke about a damager and a damagee. So what is that relationship, and how does that impact the amount of money that someone damages someone else? This year we'll see that in other ways when it's talking about maybe a contract and you didn't live up to that certain obligation, therefore you have to pay money.
Great. So what's the flesh out that difference for me?
So when we're talking about Bava Kamma, I feel like the central focus is much more on we're trying to figure out what the focus on. Is it focus on we're trying to recoup what has been lost, or are we trying to punish the damager for the breaking breach?
So we'll have similar questions this year also.
I don't know what we're seeing, but I feel like actually one of the major differentiating is that here there's existing contractual relationship that's been more than just like brotherhood being Jewish.
That's exactly right.
As opposed to the Z thing where there tends to not already exist a relationship, it's just that we're Jews or we all are people of the world and therefore we have enough responsibility.
100%. So Bava Kamma, what we'll call pure Nezikin or pure tort, is about liabilities that arises between people who don't have any special relationships or any special obligations to each other. Right, just two people on the street. A person's driving, someone else is driving, they get into an accident. What does one owe the other? How much is he liable? What duties does one person have to another? / what rights does one person have against another person when they've never met before? They've never encountered each other. What rights do I have to use a Rishus HaRabim to walk my animal there at the expense of somebody else, when there hasn't been any agreement or any special reliance or special relationship to the parties. The cases we'll see in Bava Metzia are also about liability and maybe damage even, but it's liability and damage that arises under a framework of a special relationship, whether that's contractual, where there's a kinyan or poelim, I'm working for you, or what we can call a fiduciary, where somebody is my agent. So you're a shomer who's working on my behalf to protect my item. So there's a special relationship between the parties, a relationship of trust, and you're working on my behalf. So that's going to generate special kinds of duties. So the main question here is, how are these kinds of duties and these kinds of liabilities different from the liabilities that arise in the absence of those antecedent relationships of Bava Kamma?
What's the need to differentiate different kinds of relationships? Right? Meaning, as any two people can make an agreement under any terms, you know, of any kind, it seems to me. And so the agreement I make when you sell me something should be no different fundamentally than the agreement I make where you'll do a service for me, or the agreement I make where I'll do a service for you. Or...
Yeah, but those are all special relationships still, right? I mean,
right, I'm saying, is there a reason to differentiate between a contractual relationship and a fiduciary relationship?
Yes, so we'll see. We'll talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to see the lots of distinctions in Dinin that arise along those lines, okay? But right now, I think I want to separate the fiduciary and the contract on the one hand against the Bava Kamma relationships, which are what rights and duties do we have against each other in the absence of any specified relationship. Eitan.
So could the amount of money or the stake, when the stakes are raised, could in the, let's say in the case we're talking about a special relationship with Bava Metzia, could it be that those type of cases will warrant a higher...
Yeah, we'll get that in a second. We'll get that in a second. So let me just frame this the question of relationship between the Bava Metzia categories and the Bava Kamma categories along the question of whether we think Bava Metzia is a separate Masechta from Bava Kamma, just to use that as a convenient way of thinking about this. So we can think of these different categories as essentially the same. So think of it as one Masechta, and Bava Metzia is a continuation of Bava Kamma. Just certain responsibilities or certain duties are exacerbated or made greater by the fact that there is a relationship. So we're not dealing with different species of liability. We're dealing with the same species, but you know, in the same way that Yoni was alluding to the fact that maybe there's a difference between Nezek to a Jew and Nezek to a non-Jew, that maybe there's like a different kind of relationship. So too, liability becomes more intense. The duties are stronger when there's a contract or a certain kind of fiduciary relationship, right? But we're dealing with the same species of liability. It's all nezek, right? That's one way you could go about thinking of the relationship between the stuff we'll see this year and the stuff in Bava Kamma.
That's obvious that they're the same type of duty?
No, it's not obvious at all. I think it's one way you might want to think about it.
Last year we like suggested several like strength and challenge.
Yeah.
Like that Nesivos we saw.
Yeah, but even that Nesivos, which we'll talk about later, you could say that Nesivos is just a function of, well, there are greater duties when you're a shliach or when you're a poel.
Okay, but at some point, like,
so when does the
equals difference?
Okay. So that's something to consider. But right now, when we get into the nuts and bolts of the halachos, that this question will be fleshed out further. So in that regard, I just want to point out that Gemara in the first paragraph of Bava Kamma, I didn't copy it on here, but you'll recall from last year. Gary, did you learn Bava Kamma last year?
Yeah.
Okay. So you'll recall from the first paragraph of Bava Kamma, there are different lists of the Avos Nezikin. And on some of those lists, what do we find?
Shomrim.
Right?
Well,
yeah, and there are Chiyah and Rav Oshia lists in the first part of Bava Kamma. So there are, you know, 24 Avos Nezikin, or 13. And one of the Avos Nezikin, or some of the Avos that appear, are Shomrim categories of Nezikin, which would imply that, you know, there's the spectrum from Bava Kamma to Bava Metzia, and Bava Metzia liability is just a subset of Bava Kamma liability under special relationships, but it's all Nezikin. right, as the Masechta seems to, as the idea of one Maseches Nezikin seems to indicate. Similarly, you'll recall last year, we saw briefly the Rambam's view of Poshe Akimazik. Anybody remember where Poshe Akimazik arose in the Rambam last year?
Is
that, what?
Is that in the very beginning?
Yeah, we said at the very beginning of the year.
So, second Mishnah, Oshetop Yishriyasa, Shard is Nisimo.
So, we brought it up in that context, but there's a very famous Rambam where he talks about Poshe Akimazik. Anybody remember? You probably saw this like 2 months ago. And it was here. So what, there the Gemara talks about, so we know there's a din of Ein Shmir B'Karkos. So we don't have to discuss this now. But the Rambam said that if a Shomer and Karka is Poshea, I mean he's absolutely negligent, then he's liable even though there's an Ein Shmir B'Karkos. Why? Because the Poshea is Kemazin. So that suggests that a Shmira relationship, right, the guy's just a Shomer, there's no Dine Shmir B'Karkos, but the Rambam is saying it's easy for that to morph into a pure nezek liability, right? So you could see that it sounds like there's an easy bridge between liability under shomrim and liability under nezek, at least according to the plain, the simple meaning of that Rambam. And of course, Yoni's point is well taken. Well, where do you, you know, at some point that spectrum is not just a quantitative difference, but let's hold off on that possibility for now. Is everybody clear on this general idea? Does that sound plausible to most of you? Yeah? Okay. The other view is to say that, let me flesh this out a little further. So I think underlying this first view is the idea that nezek is nezek, damage is damage, and I can become more liable the closer the relationship between the parties is. So the more distant we are, the fewer duties I owe to you. The more intimately related we are, the greater the duties that I owe to you. So you can think of like v'haftal v'rechal kamocha on a spectrum. Somebody who is maybe totally outside of your community there's no din of v'haftal v'rechal kamocha. You know, your friend has a greater din of v'haftal v'rechal kamocha, and your spouse has the greatest kiyum of v'haftal v'rechal kamocha. And the opposite is true with nezikin, right? So there's greater liability to a person who's more closely related to you, let's say a shomer, and there's lower liability for somebody who's not as directly reliant or in contact with you. That's the first view. Yakir, are you trying to say something, or is Ami in the background?
What is that?
Are you trying to say something, or are you just breaking bottles in the background? Okay, good. Hi, Yakir, by the way. You didn't get to introduce yourself. What? Okay. So we'll do Tashlumin, and we'll have a special Yakir session. Good to have you with us. The other option here, the other way of looking at this, is to view liability that arises under these special relationships as a sui generis kind of liability. And the idea is that the contract doesn't merely bring the parties into a special relationship, but the contract is what creates the liabilities. So it's not just the contract, the agreement, or the shmir relationship is not just a hechatimti to say these parties are intimately connected, but the point is that a contract creates certain kinds of liabilities for breaking it. And the same thing is true for a shomer. Or you could say a shomer is a kind of a contractual relationship. The contract obligates him to do certain things, and the contract penalizes him or makes him liable for breaking its terms. Totally unrelated with the world of the Zikin of Bava Kama. Now this would speak to an important difference between the Bava Kama liability and the Bava Metzia liability, which we'll flesh out shortly. Is everybody with me so far? Okay. Let me just point to two formulations in the Rishonim here. So the first is Iuris psicha tu sekta bamitzia. Anybody take a look at this? Wasn't a sign. Get extra points if you always happen to just read the Iuris Akdama. It's highly recommended. You know, the Miri is a good Aristotelian, so you know the important thing is to organize the Masechta for you right at the outset. Right? Oh, the Masechta is going to teach you six things. The Rambam does something similar in Perashat Mishnayos, but the Rambam does it only in the Akdama to Perashat Mishnayos. The Miri does it at every Masechta and every chapter, every paragraph. So look at the Miri here says. You know, I already told you in the introduction to Bava Kama that these three mesechtos, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, and Bava Basra, Shlashtag mesechta achas, Chaluka l'shlosh asharim. Right, so it's one mesechta with three separate components. And again, this is exactly the tension between the relationship between the Bava Metzia part and the Bava Kama part. V'chein b'yarnu sham, v'inyan shloshes ha-mesechta shebesovev levar yikare hadinim. So there's no din in nefashos in the sefes nesikin. Ubo in yoni hashara rishon as bava kama levar hadinim vehatvios habos mizel azem mitzad hanezek hamagia mimenu lechaveiro hein mitzad mamono hein mitzad gufo. So this is his characterization of bava kama, which is what, Ben? What's the salient part of his description of Bava Kama? Or let's read the Bava Metzia part, and you can tell me what the contrast is. Ubo in yone hashar hasheni at Bava Metzia levar hadinim b'tfios habos b'derech taina me'adam lechaveiro shalom yitzad hezik ela machmas tainos achiros k'inyan ha-machlokas b'metzia So what?
Which is what you're saying sort of the beginning. The line that Sultan was talking about was cutting it much shorter. There's a line between what's nesting and much more narrow skill.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. Notice how the Miri is very precise here in distinguishing what he sees as nezek. That's Bava Kama. So Bava Kama is Dinin Vatvios Habos Mizal Mitzad Hezek. Right, and that Hezek can either be Niske Gufar or Niske Mamono. Now, it's interesting, the Hebrew word Nezek is somewhat ambiguous. It just means, you know, harm or damage. Right? From this Meiri, it sounds like he means it closer to this usage of tort, meaning it's a wrong that doesn't arise from any civil relationship. Right, from any special relationship. It's just, you know, nezek means harm caused by people acting at an arm's length, at an arm's distance, right, with no special ties. Ben.
Maybe I could go deeper to see that it's also a difference of what is the...
Let me just say, and you see it's explicit in the Bava Metzia side, and Bava Metzia and Dina Betzios Bederech Taina, certain claims that you have, Shalom Mitzah Hezek, right? These are claims that arise from something other than the harm suffered.
Right. So yeah, the object of what was damaged, it seems to have a common mamono gufo, which also seems like pretty, I guess, the mamono gufo, but see it's objects, it's the because of the yana, but then simply kamos, and then kinyana, it would be more like your labor, as opposed to like one's physical body and their money.
Yeah, so the way I would put this, unless somebody else wants to point out the important contrast here. So it's nezek versus tainos that comes shalom achmas hezek. But what else do you see as important in this distinction? So no, I don't think that's so important.
Inspired by.
You can still scream out. You know, if it's, you only need hands if you're competing for somebody else. But.
Uh, we're always competing here in the competition tour.
Okay.
Inspired a little bit by the first key reading, right? Bava Metzia emphasizes the role of a person making a tie-dye against another person, as opposed to Bava Kama, where it seems like the notion of a tzvia is almost secondary to when you cause damage.
Yes. Yes, I think that's exactly what I think the Miri is distinguishing between. Notice how it sounds from the first line that nezek in Bava Kama is what gives rise to the liability. Right, so it like begins with nezek. Here, what gives rise is right? They come through these other kinds of claims. So it's not the loss which that powers. The loss itself doesn't power the system of Amitzia. Right? That would be Nezek based. What powers the system of Amitzia is Tainos arising from these kinds of relationships. That's what you're getting at here? Yeah, so I think that speaks to this important difference between Nezek, what we'll call tort, and these other relationships, call it fiduciary relationships or contractual relationships, which give rise, they create their own systems of liability. Eitan, is that clear?
Good.
Yeah? Awesome. I think it's a very nice formulation from Mir. Yoni?
But it sounds like it's not just about that, there's a contractual obligation. It sounds like he's saying that. Like the time as itself, like an imperative part of the
yes,
like an integral part of the claim here, as opposed to when Nezek, you need the time, but it's
yeah,
it stands on its own a little bit.
That's right. Meaning, Nezek generates liability in Bava Kama, whereas
time.
Yes, you might say the claims are what generates liability in Bava Metzia. Right? I think that's like an interesting way of putting it. So just as an interesting something to think about, you might even say, well, what about like something like Avodah Nishtilah and Afshek? Maybe that's limited to Nezek, where like the Nezek itself generates it, but if the claim has to generate liability, then maybe there's no Avodah Nishtilah and Afshek because there has to be some tribunal to validate the claim. Right? So maybe that's like one interesting way of trying to flesh out this distinction. Okay, any questions about this so far? Anybody? Okay. Look again at his formulation in the next paragraph. So Bava Metzia is in Yoneha Moshav Yarm is sovin bedine hatfiyo sabos nadam lachavero shelo ayde hazekupo mono ella al yine kainos hutviyo mizel lezeh. Right, they're just claims that people have against each other. And then he proceeds to divide himself into these different categories. But I think Yoni's right, and Yair is right, that there's this important fault line between Nezek versus Tainos Bomitzia. So here's the Rambam in Zakdon and Pirshim Shnayis. I think the Rambam is less informative, but just take a quick look at the Rambam's formulation here in the Hakdama, where he talks about Seder Nezikin. And tell me what you think about his formulation.
The top or the second?
These are both Rambam. Take a look at both. So here we're talking about Chilek Ravi, he's talking about Seder Nezikin in general. And over here, he's talking about, he's fleshing out what's in Seder Nezikin.
the second part is just saying something with the Purinazi, like similar.
I mean, Abba Dina had Kainos, Vahapik Donos, and Skidros, and
Tvidos. He's like saying it much more that's what he's saying.
Yeah. Well,
that last line, though, that's bolded, that underline is interesting. After giving a short word, the last line of the second bolded part.
After giving the comma, after our comma.
Yeah.
After giving a short word, however.
Not an underline, arbitral.
Well, he's just saying that the reason why Bamatsia followed Boba Kama is because after it follows Sitter Absukim.
Right.
So after he talks about Shara Bor, Tata Chi Natsu Anashim Yachat, Yachta, or Chi Natsu Anashim Yachta, is that it?
So.
Thanks, sir.
No, I was just going to say that
it's separate, but it's still building off of.
Right.
It's hard to know. I think the Rambam was less informative here about the.
I think the last one, the other one, is more interesting.
Which one?
The end of the first paragraph.
Yes. I think that's right.
Because that seems suggesting that in some ways Ezekiel, well, not just that Ezekiel is more important, like sorry, that the Yahweh is more important, that's what he's saying, it's like for precedence, but he's also focusing on the role of the Dayan, the role of the judge.
Yes.
Kind of like society, I guess, in avoiding Ezekiel.
So that was very interesting. If you look at the Psalm carefully, he's obsessed with the role of the Dayan. That's what Rambam makes sense why Sanhedrin is in the Zikin, and because that's really the role of the Dayanim in doing all these things. So that is interesting. I think there's something in addition to that.
He doesn't have them taking over the Messiah. The Messiah sounds like it.
What was your share? The translating to it, Selot and the Zikin.
Selot.
Selot and the Zikin. So how would you translate that?
So I think one way of translating it is to deter. But probably more precise is to say, to ensure that there are no Nezikin in society.
Well, it seems like radical. Right.
So notice the Rambam's not worried here about ex post facto. This is very consistent with what we saw last year. Rambam is not worried about ex post facto. I damage you, what liability do I have? Which is, Miri seems to have it, right? It's about liability that arises when I damage you. The Rambam is saying, no. Bava Kama is all about deterring damage. He says it over here also, earlier on. The Sasa Lesser and Zikin, Hissa Bava Kama, and Yana Medina and Zikin Umini Yasa, how to prevent damages from coming about.
I also think he's describing a primary importance to the Zikin in this context, and one of them, let's see, like, he's saying, why? Let's check. What is Lahti? Is Lahti supposed to what?
Locked him?
As before DNA Bobatia.
Yeah, why is Bobakama before Bobatia? So he's saying the reason why it's before is because there is a more pressing necessity to get rid of basic harm before you could get into these kinds of tainos and those things. I mean, like, if you're ordering a society, what's the first thing you have to do? What's the more basic responsibility of the diamond? Yeah, it sounds like he's saying, yes, protecting people is like, removing torques is like the more basic obligation. Once you solve that, then you can move on to Bava Metzia issues.
Sort of like the...
But you notice this, so it sounds like the relationship between the two of them is like how essential they are for a functioning society. Not this conceptual difference between liability that arises under Nezek and liability that arises under specific Tainos. The Rambam is pretty vague. I mean, he doesn't say much. But my point here is just to emphasize that the Rambam thinks that the reason why they're separate is just because this is more fundamental. L'sal Hanezek is more fundamental for society than to worry about these more specified or more specialized kinds of liability of pikdonos and schiros, etc.
I think the prevent mindset for the Rambam is interesting, specifically in light of Hoshea Kamasik, meaning like we're trying to prevent, even we'll go so far as we're trying to prevent negligence, that could be negligence, which is fascinating because it's Skiris. What do you do with Skiris? Is it part of Shulman stuff? Is it other stuff? Meaning it's just, so I think he's doing a lot, like you said, it's pretty vague, but the fact that he's talking about the prevent and we're trying to avoid that, says like maybe why he felt it was important to say Hoshea Kamasik.
Yeah, it could be
the literals.
Yeah, it's a little speculative. but it's possible. So look, I think the Mahiri has a very clear distinction between the categories. The Rambam is less clear, but I would say that for the Rambam, the difference. I would go out on a limb to say the Rambam views Tavakamba and Matiya as much more related. The distinction between them is just in an order of importance for social welfare. So we have to make sure that people aren't torching your homes and destroying your property. Once we make sure that people aren't destroying your property, then we can figure out about how we're going to enforce agreements between a contractor and a balabayas, or how we're going to enforce an agreement between a socher and a maskir, a landlord and a tenant.
But the Rambam and the Meir are answering a question. Right? The Meir is explaining why one Mesechta called Mezikin was divided into three, called Baba Kamba and Zir Baba Atra. To do that, you have to define a distinction between the categories. The Rambam is explaining why they're putting the order that they're putting. He presupposes the distinction. Or is it division?
That he presupposes the...
He presupposes the division between Baba and Zir Baba Atra.
I think the Rambam is not explaining why they're different, right? You're right. He's answering the question about why they ordered this way. So he's answering the ordering question. Here he's answering why they're different. One thing you could say is the Rambam doesn't really see the distinction as significant. Right? This is Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, it's Baba Masechta. Why is the Masechta ordered with this thing first? Because this is more important for society. Right? V'chilek in Yoni HaMasechta HaRishona
L'shlosh
HaChalakim. Yeah. Right? So the idea here even suggests that the Rambam sees them as like a...
Right, they're three, you know, they're all parts of the Nerzikin.
That's right. And why is it ordered this way? Because of this reason. All right. Everybody with me? Everybody, any other comments? Or Donnie, you have a comment? Sounds good, Ram and Miri. Ben? Yoni? Leif? Okay. Eitan? Yair? Great. So let me give you a quick overview of what we're going to focus on in the Masechta. And start giving some pointers about the core question in our first topic.
Can I just comment on the Talmud Rambam? There's something within the Rambam saying that there's something more fundamental about the Nezek development. See, the Baba Kama.
Yes.
Meaning, so if we were going to go according to what we had said earlier, that the difference is really based on the types of relationships between the people. You could make the argument that things discussed about the Metziah are just as fundamental as one of the Ezekiel. They're just as fundamental if we're talking about a different type of relationship.
Okay, so I think so everybody understand Ben's point?
Sure.
It's an interesting point. Make your point again. It's a very abstract point, but it's a very, very interesting point.
Lorala is making a point that the difference between Baba Kama and Matsya is based on the fact that the Nezek discussed Baba Kama is more fundamental, more important for society. Seemingly, it's worse if we don't have the DNA Nezek in Baba Kama than if we don't have the DNA Kama and Matsya. One of the first models we had discussed, though, is that the real difference is based on the different types of relationships. Ezekiel is just like a random person to see on the street, but Matsya is like somebody who has some sort of actual relationship. If you were to just view it as a difference of relationships, perhaps...
But the same kind of liability, right? The same kind of wrongdoing.
Right, that perhaps those relationships...
It's just as fundamental.
Just as fundamental.
Probably more.
Well?
Probably more important, now it's closer.
Ah. Okay, so Ben, what I mean by Ben making a very abstract point, you're a good conceptualist, right? Because you're saying, look, if conceptually the damage is all the same... Right. But I say conceptually the damage is all the same. The nezek is the same between a shomer and a mafkid and between two random Joes on the street. Right? It's the same. The thing that occurs, the wrongdoing, is all nezek. And so one shouldn't be more fundamental than the other. My response to that is that, well, you're thinking about it too conceptually. Because the Rambam's thinking about it in terms of social order. Right? So... In terms of setting up a society, Michobas Adayin Lachim Tchila Tzila Kandizakim Ibn Adam. Tchila here means, I think, in chronological order. So when you're setting up a society, first you have to have basic rules about if one person has property, this is what you can do to it. You can't trespass, you can't take it, you can't destroy it, etc. Once you establish those basic rules, you assign property rights and explain the liability rules of property rights, then you can ask, well, what happens if we enter into a special relationship, I contract your services, but it's a more sophisticated kind of a question than just the rudimentary question about, well, how do we protect people's property rights?
So you're saying it's not this, it's something that's different.
So I'm saying conceptually, they may arise under the same principle of liability, a violation of someone's property right, or a breach of duty. But one of them, even though they're conceptually the same, one of them is pragmatically more fundamental to setting up a good society. That's what I think the answer is. Anyway, do you have thoughts on Ben's question or my answer to it? Ben, does that answer your question then?
Yeah.
More or less?
Yeah. So.
If you're a real conceptualist, it's not, why would the Rambam care about, how to set up a good society? But I think from his language, it sounds like that's what he's trying to explain, right? He's not telling you something profound about the nature of...
Right, so I'm inclined to agree with that object, yeah.
Right. So, if I wanted to be if I didn't want my parents to write me out of the Yerusha for not being a good conceptualist, I would say, oh, this is just the Roman Pershing Shnayis. The Roman Yad HaZaka never would have said this. Okay. So, here's the overview of the stuff that we're going to discuss throughout the year. If you look at the Meiri, in his Hakdama, he divides the Masechta into 8 categories. So he says the first part of the Masechta is about lost objects. What rights does the finder have in the lost object? What duties does the finder owe to the owner? The second part of the Masechta is about pikadons. Right? Somebody gives you an object to watch and you're a shomer. What liabilities arise under a fee of shmira? The third part of the Masechta, which we're not going to talk about much, is about transfers. That's an azav. Zav, kones, hakesef, and kinyanim. So kinyan kesef and stuff like that. And along with kinyanim, you get things like chalipin, etc. You also get dine ona, because we talk about transactions. You have to have fair pricing for the transactions. That's all part of the third part of the Masechta. The fourth part is ribis and loans. Presumably that's related to the third part. It's all about fair commercial transactions, so fair pricing, fair money lending. The fifth part is about schiros behema and schiros polim. So these are, you might call them employment relations, or contractor-contractee relationships. I contract your services, what do you owe me, what do I owe you? So he has the fifth category in Sakta. The sixth is about Sfiris Batim, landlord-tenant relations. The seventh part of the Masechta is about sharecropping relationships. So I'm leasing your field, I'm going to work the field, I'm going to give you a percentage of the profits. What are my responsibilities to you? Am I allowed to leave it fallow, etc.? What are your responsibilities to me? Along with that are certain discussions of paying your workers on time. That's all part of the seventh part. And the eighth part, the Meiri says, doesn't really belong in this Masechta. It really should be part of Bavasra. But that's about a dispute between somebody who owns the upstairs floor and somebody who owns the downstairs floor. So they own like a co-op or something. And the question is, how do they split their various liabilities within the house itself? That's Meiri's overview of the Masechta. It's a nice overview, but I'm going to get a better overview about the stuff that we're going to focus on over the course of the semester. I think this is, it's conceptually reorganized. So I'm bringing the Masechta down into, I think, 10 important categories. So the first let's call contracts. This will be our first preoccupation. It arises under the Gemara's discussion of Sefiras Poalim. And here we're going to ask a few fundamental questions. So the first, I feel bad that Ben is missing this. Should we wait for Ben? What's the...
What's the bathroom?
Or you leave at your own risk. That's the rule, right?
Yeah.
Leaves at his own risk. So the first question is, well, when does a kinyan go into effect? So what distinguishes, or when is the contract consummated or executed? So we'll see, there's all sorts of rules that govern discussions about forming an agreement. So I tell Ben, I buy my house, I'll give you a good deal. Ben says, yeah, I'll buy it. So there's like, let's call it an agreement to agree, but there's no actual kinyan yet, right? So I'm discussing hiring Ben to paint my house. So what distinguishes the mere discussions, and Ben says, yeah, sure, I'll do it, from an enforceable agreement that now he's liable for if he breaches? How do you distinguish? Does anybody know offhand? But, so it's a very tricky question. So Maisa Kinyan, maybe, although it's not clear that Maisa Kinyan always works with these things. Right? Like, it's not good at signing an agreement or raising a handkerchief will work. But for the lack of a better term, let's just call it a kinyan, right? When is the kinyan executed, slash when is it just agreement? We'll see from the Gemara is actually in Hazav that there are all sorts of rules about backing out before the agreement is even consummated. Right? The Gemara calls somebody who's mechusar amana, or somebody who deserves misha para for backing out of an agreement. That's even prior to there being liability for breaching the agreement. Right? So there are certain rules that you're bound by to abide by your word in agreeing to agree to have a contract. So this is going to be a very important question. You know, what distinguishes the existence of the contract from discussions about it? And secular law, it's a huge issue also, sometimes consideration. The fact that there's a bargain for exchange is what distinguishes a contract, which is an enforceable agreement, from just a mere promise, which is not enforceable.
What's consideration?
So consideration is that you got something in exchange for what you were giving. So if I say, Yair, you're a great guy, I'm giving you my computer as a gift. Okay? So that's a promise that's not enforceable. But if I say, Yair, you're a great guy, I'm giving you my computer, and you say, oh, and in consideration for my receiving your computer, I'll give you my pencil, then that's an enforceable contract.
Right away.
Well?
Right away, just like I discussed it.
Yeah.
Because money is changing? Because value is
because
changing.
I received, we exchanged, it's called exchange promises. Because I gave him something, my promise to give him the computer, and he gave me something.
Is there a limit to the price of the object that you like, have to exchange?
No, so it's
an ounce.
Right. It doesn't have to be courts don't care about whether the exchange is reasonable.
So your partner's just like supposed to like.
Yeah, it's just the mere fact that there's consideration, meaning you got something. And that's what distinguishes in the common law a mere promise from an enforceable contract.
Even for employment?
Well, see, in halacha, there's no, consideration is not really important.
Even for employment, I say like, oh, I'll work, oh, I'll like, go over your house for $100 and say yes. Like once that
yeah,
happens,
if there's a even happens, an oral agreement is enforceable if there is consideration, right? So in consideration for you painting my house, I'll give you $100. If you say yes, you accepted it, so that's binding. It's always better to have it in paper because it's easier to enforce. But the distinction between just a mere promise and a contract, which is enforceable, second law is acceptance and consideration. And halacha seems a little trickier, what exactly is. But there's a world of a difference, right? I mean, there's a world of a difference between just giving your word to do something and this contract arising, which is enforceable, you know, in court, and you'll suffer damages for not going through with it. Okay? So that's one of the core questions that we're going to we're going to look at early on. Another core question is, what are the proper remedies / damages for breaching an agreement in halacha? So I'm going to give you a separate reading to take a look at, but what do you think the proper damages ought to be? You know, so in the Zikin, we saw some discussions about, you know, how are you properly compensated? What do you think the proper compensation should be, or the proper remedy for breaking an agreement? So I hire Eitan to paint my house, and he decides that he can get a better rate from somebody else. So he breaches the agreement. Now he doesn't show up. Instead of getting paid $20 an hour, he goes to paint Donnie's house for $25 an hour. So what does Eitan owe me?
I would say one of at least two things. The first thing I would say is that you owe the money that was promised. So if it was $20 an hour for a week, however much that is, I have to give back to you, assuming that there was some sort of debt.
So I was going to pay you $20 an hour to paint my house.
Okay.
You don't show up. So you're going
to... Have you paid me yet or no?
No. And I'm having guests for Shabbos, and I wanted to make sure that my house was painted, and now it's not going to be painted. Donnie.
How much money would it cost to now buy someone get a new person?
To hire somebody else to do the job.
Yeah, but time constraints, I guess, are probably
more expensive. So, meaning, Eitan's got to put me back into the position I would have been in had he completed the agreement, right? So, let's take a different case. Let's say that I contract Eitan to deliver 100 pounds of chicken at $12 a pound. Eitan then finds a buyer who's willing to pay him $20 a pound of chicken. So he fails to deliver to me, and he sells, let's say, to Ben this time. So I can't find any chickens to buy at the $12 rate. So I have to go buy now, let's say, at the $20 rate.
Do I have to give the $8?
Yeah, so how much do you think Eitan owes me? So the $8 per pound difference, right? So I can go buy and maybe some extra cost.
It's not going to depend if there are other tasty people or not.
Yeah.
If there's another event, another delivery person, so that's $12 or $13. Why should you pay $20?
Good. So we'll get to that in a second. It's a very good point. Let me just ask this. Why should the remedy be that Eitan pays me the $8 difference? Why shouldn't the proper remedy be that we compel Eitan to sell the chickens to me? What's called sometimes specific performance. Right? Why don't we compel him to perform the contract rather than allowing him to get off by paying damages? Yeah.
So you could say, it's like a dark way of thinking about the world of business, but perhaps when someone finds a better deal, we're not going to say, hey, don't do that deal. So what we'll do is to make sure that the guy we had the original contract with isn't totally screwed over.
Good.
We'll cover the remaining gap of cost.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're saying that the reason why we allow for you just to pay out damages rather than compelling you to actually perform on the obligation is because it's more economically efficient. Right? We want to give the contractee, in this case, you, the opportunity to make some extra money, right? As long as I'm not harmed, because you're paying off what, right? You're paying off my losses. You're paying me what it costs me now to buy chicken. But it's like better for you. Like maybe you could sell your chickens at $21 a pound, so you'll make an extra profit, and you could, and I'll be able to purchase from someone at $20 a pound, something like that. Does that sound? So it sounds like Eitan's saying that we should choose pay out damages rather than system performance, because it's more economically efficient. Right? Is that what you're...
Yeah.
So what do you make of that?
What are those options you said? You see those as
exclusive? Yes, think about it. Somebody breaches an agreement, right? So there are two kinds of remedies you can think of off the bat, right? But one is to let him pay the expectation damages, meaning let Eitan pay me the amount that I was expected to make off the contract, right? So if it was, if the point was that I was expected to get 100 pounds of chicken, then he just has to pay me whatever it's going to cost me to get those chickens now. The other possibility is to compel specific performance, meaning compel Eitan to actually go ahead and deliver the pounds of chickens that he was obligated to deliver.
Be like an amount that sort of is just meant to coerce him to do it.
What? Not an amount, but actually make him make good on the contract. Take the chickens out of his warehouse or take them away from whoever he sold them to. Right? So like in a contract case, like if I contract you to paint my home and Donnie offered you a better price, but we already have a contract, so then maybe the proper remedy is to make you paint my home rather than to allow you just to pay off damages. That's the question. So why, I mean, which one of those do you think is the better rule? Eitan gave us a reason for thinking that maybe the payout damage is a better rule.
Right? It's a lot more inefficient.
Which is? It's less efficient.
Yeah, because like, yeah, you have to fight. It's one more since I broke the contract, I don't want to work for you. Or you're going to have to go to court, the court's going to have to like tell them to go do it. It should take a lot more time instead of, in the meantime,
write a check.
In the meantime, the guy hires someone else and then he sues him for the difference. You should walk over.
Okay. Saying like another efficiency.
It seems like a very legal procedure.
Which is also building on that, there would be a lot more. It's hard to gauge exactly what that expectation of damage cost would be. Okay, you were saying that you can only get chickens for $20, but maybe you know an hour away you can't get chicken dollars.
Yeah.
So you have to then factor in how much you factor
the cost
in far away.
Right.
It's hard to...
Well, this is what most litigation is about. Most litigation
right.
is about, well, how much are they damages, right? How much do I damage by the breach of agreement?
Correct. That's what if you choose to repair it according to that rather.
As opposed to just compelling.
Right. You're saying that would be more efficient just to compel.
He's saying that compelling is less efficient because...
Take more time.
Right. So he's saying, I need my chickens for supper tonight. It's going to take a while for me to compel him to deliver the chicken, so let me buy from somebody else and just let the breacher compensate me.
I don't want to wait a year until we finally
right.
resolve this issue
right.
before
right.
the chickens.
So you're saying it's almost like a practical constraint that it's by the time the courts get involved and it's litigated, like compelling performance may no longer be relevant.
Well, otherwise, I think that the performance is fair.
So why don't we give the plaintiff an option then? Let him sue for specific performance or for expectation, whichever of the two is better for him. Right? We'll see. Once we get into the sugya, it's actually a very interesting question. It's not clear in halacha whether you can compel specific performance at all. But, hey, Donnie, you want to say something?
Oh, is there any tension with like the actual opinion of the other sale that actually happened?
I mean, to like a presumption that we don't want to undo a third-party sale.
Yeah, or like, yeah, to whoever actually bought the chickens, and then there was an actual kinyan that happened versus this agreement that we have. Like, those things could be intentional.
Yes, except that if he had no right to buy the chickens...
No, but so maybe... Like, maybe that trumps the
right.
Actual kinyan.
It's like, Asi Maisa Vavata Ledibor kind of thing. Okay, but let's just take an easy case where he didn't actually sell them yet.
Okay,
so maybe in that case we should compel specific performance. But you see how these are two different kinds of remedies, and we have to figure out what's the basis for the remedies in the first place to understand which is the proper remedy for breaching the agreement. Eitan.
Just a couple of comments. Number one, I think I really agree with what Yoni's saying, even though I raised the possible reason, but it's not necessarily with it. Specifically because I think that I'm a person who believes that, I guess, Bava Metzia is kind of coming off of or growing and expanding from Bava Kamma. We spoke a lot last year about the relationship between compensation for what has happened, punishment, is there an isser in Ezekiel? We spent a lot of time talking about that. I feel like by messing over your partner, and just getting back to square zero, like in the chicken case, if I'm selling it for 20 to another guy, and I can cover the 8 gap, it's as if I sold it to you for 12, and nothing, it's as if nothing happened.
Right.
It's like this long, circuitous thing.
Right.
Occurred.
Back to the status quo.
Back to square zero.
It's like a reset.
I feel like there should be, like, the guy who messed up.
Should be punished.
Not punished. There should be something that, like, yeah, a slap on the wrist or something, but that doesn't exist at all.
So I was reading something, and some, I think in Israel, they're more, they do this more readily than in the States. So, in addition to requiring the breacher to pay expectation damages, they also would require him to disgorge any gains he made from selling to a third party. That's like the knuts. I mean,
right.
So,
does it go to the government or goes to
the injured party.
Oh, that's
yeah. Right. It's like, but that's like a punishment on us, right? To deter, which is intentional with what you were saying earlier, that we don't want to, you know, if the breach is helpful for everyone, meaning the plaintiff doesn't lose, the injured party doesn't lose because he's made whole again, the breacher gains because he sold it to a third party for extra profit, then why not allow this? Right. So for economic reasons, it's beneficial to everybody. Right. It's more efficient. But why would you like what?
Why would you want that as someone who's meaning the seller? It's almost like we're promoting like shady business, almost in the sense that, you know, hunt for the best deal possible, and until you find that, and you say, okay, this is the best deal I want, You have two parties. So let's say you have 7 cases where
okay.
10 chicken, right? You have $10 you're selling it, then 12, 14, 16, it's all the way down until 20. That is just an absolute crazy way to have a society work economically.
Well, I think we'll say that. So you're saying there's an internal economic consideration.
Right.
That maybe
if there are more than one party being messed up.
The whole point of a contract is to rely on your side. But if everybody's going to breach when it's more efficient, then we've undermined the system of contracts.
Right.
That's one way of looking at it.
But isn't it like a societal expectation at some point that like people are being punished? And then like if the person's known that the person breaches contract, people are going to be less willing to make contracts again.
Okay.
There's like a certain amount of social. Pride.
Assuming there's like perfect information.
No. Okay.
Like their information costs are.
At least like one time it's not going to happen. But like, overall, people do.
Yeah.
The invisible hand is going to control. Them.
Right.
It certainly is like a concept of like, oh, this guy's a reliable person, like his word is his bond versus people who are like a lot of
cheaters. Right. Right.
I can think of a guy who lives in a white house
now. But what's the other side to this? What's the other side of this? So why might you want to compel specific performance even if damages is more efficient overall? Right? Because the breaching party gains and
fair.
Ah, exactly right. I mean, let's look at this from the perspective of fairness. Or morally speaking, right, the party has a moral obligation to go through with the agreement. Right? So you might say that which remedy we choose will depend on what the fundamental basis for a contract in the first place is. Meaning, what's the basis of why society enforces contractual agreements? So, like, I have an agreement with Donnie about painting my house. Why should the state step in to award damages for a private agreement between the parties? So, there are different theories here. Some of them are economic, that maybe contract is just a creation for reasons of economic efficiency. Society does better when we can rely on each other's promises. But the other view is that, no, a contract actually creates certain rights and duties through the idea of, let's say, a promise. Right? There are certain promises that are not just... because there's... When I make a promise to Donnie in certain cases, I actually owe him something, or I transfer certain rights to him, like a property transfer. So when he promises to come and paint my house, he's actually transferred a right to me to have my house painted by him, and it's like I have a certain ownership stake. He transferred an entitlement to me. And so then there are moral grounds for enforcing that, not just grounds of economic efficiency. Does everybody see that this is gonna be a very important question about what's the basis for enforcing these contractual agreements, and that's gonna bear on what kind of remedy is appropriate. Okay. Let me just raise one more point under this heading before we move on. So we spoke about expectation damages, and expectation damages is put me back in the position that I expected to be in if the contract were seen through. But there's something else that we can speak of, and that's reliance damages. So don't pay me the difference to get chickens back at $20. So if I was going to buy chickens from Eitan for $12, and he went and sold them to somebody else for $20, and now let's say I can only buy them for $20. Let's say I can only buy them for $25. So you would have to pay me
$13.
The difference, right? To put me back in the position that I'm in. Let's say that Eitan is going to sell it to me for $12. He breached and sold it for $20. But I can find somebody who will still sell it to me for $12. So are there any damages due?
That's what the constant comes into play a lot.
Well,
just for the inconvenience of reaching the, or the fact that I broke the agreement should be worthy of some sort of slap on the wrist. Not necessarily because I have been, I lost out on the opportunity to buy for $12, but simply because I thought I was, like you said, reliable. I mean, the expectation was that, okay, we're going to do it, we're going to have a contract together, and then I'm going to give you the chickens that you want to buy. And once that breaches, regardless of the fact that the money goes up or goes down or stays the same, it should be that I have to pay for the fact that I broke that agreement. Meaning, you could buy chicken for $12. You could buy it for $10. You could buy it for less.
Good.
Or nothing.
Yeah.
Get it for free. But the fact that I've breached should be impactful to the situation.
This is an interesting question, right? I mean, so you could have cases where Eitan does something wrong by breaching the agreement.
But you gain also.
Right, but my reliance on the contract didn't cause me to suffer any damages. So, arguably, you might say, that in that kind of a case, there was no nezek. Even though he deprived me of the agreement between us. So, sometimes this is called the distinction between expectation damages versus reliance damages. I mean, if my reliance caused me to suffer no loss. So, the theory is, one thing you might say is that if this kind of liability is really similar to nezek, like a bava kama kind of liability that just arises from the special relationship of the agreement, then if I'm at no loss, should I be entitled to recover? Okay, Donnie? Seem like no, right? Because the contract is a hechatimtzi for triggering nezek under bava kama dinim. So if I'm not at any loss, then maybe there's no basis for damages. Whereas, if you think that the contract gave me certain entitlements, then maybe there's room for me to collect on the breach, even if I didn't suffer anything by relying upon it. Something to consider. This will be important enough to me now.
And the breach would be just from a moral perspective?
Yeah. Like, he promised, he was duty bound to supply me with chickens. And he didn't supply me, he didn't give me the thing that was owed to me. And so I can sue him for damages. We'll talk more about this. Right now I just want to give a general. Okay, so that's the first topic. And we're going to talk about stuff like, you know, how do you interpret ambiguous agreements? What happens if certain parts of the agreement are not specified. So you can see in this outline, I basically put where each sugya is in the discussion with Mark. So the second topic is about the nature of employment relationships. So the relationship between an employer and employee. So for example, the Gemara says that Yad Poel is Ki Yad Balabayis. So the worker is like an extension of his employer. So like his productive labor belongs to the employer. We'll ask what rights does an employee have against his employer. For example, he has a right to eat the foods if he's working on something that's mechubah lekarka. He's also peros. he has like certain rights to be paid on time, like the issue of Alana Skarsafir. And we'll see, does he have a right to work for another employer to moonlight if it's going to affect his job with his current employer? Right, so what rights and duties are there between an employer and an employee? The next topic is really just related, but it's more general Schiwas issues. We don't have to get into this now. Right, so the first stuff is more applicable to Schiwas Paulin, but then they might talk about Schiwas Behema, Schiwas Batim, Schiwas Sadeh. That's an important part of the contract Schiwas discussion. The third major topic is Shomrim. Now, Shomrim is an interesting case. It's somewhere in between contract and fiduciary, where the Shomer is really working as an agent on behalf of the Mafkid. So it's not just like, oh, I'm going to sell you a product or something. He's acting on his behalf to exercise Shmira.
It's like a Shliach.
So yes, you might say it's like agency almost, right? It's like stronger. So there are a lot of interesting questions that arise in Shomrim. Here you can see in the outline, we're going to talk about what are the difference between Shomer Chinam, Shomer Sachar, Shoel, and Socher. We're going to try to figure out what underlies the different liabilities of Shomrim. Why does this Shomer have liability X, but that Shomer have liability Y? We're going to talk about how to initiate Shmira, like executing the contract, when is it going to affect? How do you execute a Shmira relationship and how do you terminate it? And we'll see, what does that reflect about the obligations of a Shomer in general? We'll talk about the standard of Shmira. What kind of Shmira is a Shomer expected to exercise? And amongst other topics, we'll talk about what rights or what quasi-ownership rights does a Shomer gain in the object that he's watching. So here are some really interesting discussions. Can he use the object?
It'll depend on what type of Shomer it is.
Yeah, we'll flesh this out more precisely. Can he sell the object under certain conditions, Umar talks about, which would imply that he has like quasi-ownership rights. In a case of damages, does he retain the actual object and just compensate for the value, or does he have to actually return the object? And if the object is stolen from the Shomer, who's entitled to the kefel? Right, the owner or the Shomer? This raises an important question about, who exactly is the owner, or who has title to the object while it's under the Shomer's supervision.
When we talk about all these relationships, and this may be a question that we'll explore further, but is one bound to all of the details as we outline them, or can I appoint a Shomer with the time?
Okay. We'll talk about that.
Great.
We'll talk about Asmachta. That's the fourth topic I have here. Asmachta belongs more with the contract issue, because asmachta is a huge problem for certain understandings of contracts. So to Yair's point, well, can't we just contract about anything? And certainly the straightforward reading of Dini Asmachta suggests that if something is inaccessible for whatever reason, or it's not a right that you presently hold, depending on your understanding of asmachta, then it's not subject to contracts. Right? So I can't contract about something that's not presently in my rishos. One interpretation of asmachta. So in the asmachta section, we'll talk about why is it that you're not able to contract through an asmachta, and what does that reflect about contracts in general in halakha. Okay, the next two sections are much more general in nature. They touch on the question that Yair just raised. And here, so we're moving away from fiduciary and contract relationships, and we're entering into more general questions about how flexible are the parties to stipulate any conditions and any arrangements that they want between themselves. So specifically, on Sadidala, the Gemara discusses Kol Tanai Shem Mamon Kayim. So the Gemara sets out all these default rules, but how free are the parties to make their own rules, right? That's your question. And are they free, are they not free, and what does that reflect about the rules in general? Then the sixth topic comes up several times in the Masechta, and the Peis, and the Tzadis, and the Kufs, that there's a very strong presumption, especially when an agreement is not specific, that the rules are just governed by Minhag HaMedina. And sometimes it applies even when the rules are specific, they're overridden by Minhag HaMedina. So the background question I want to ask is, well, why is Minhag HaMedina so decisive in governing people's contractual agreements? So what role does Minhag HaMedina play in all these questions? And what does it reflect about the rules themselves? Everyone on board for that? Okay, so the last three topics. So the next topic, the seventh topic that we'll discuss, is general rules of dispute resolution. So we have Machlokas Sumchos and Chachamim. Do you just say Yachloku when there's a disagreement, or do you say Motzi Mechaviro al Baraya? Munach HaChiyavu Eliyahu, what's going on there? The Gemara has some very interesting discussions about Kasher Asa Kini Asa Lo. If somebody acts deceptively, then you could use these extraordinary equitable means to punish him, or to, in the same way that he acted unjustly, you could almost act unjustly against him. We'll take a closer look at that discussion later. I promise that we'll finish at 12:30, so I'll just tell you what the next ones are, and then I'll talk about them next time. So the eighth topic that we'll talk about is bialos ownership. Super interesting ownership questions that come out in the Bavitzia. Supererogatory obligations, that's our ninth topic, which can be sure said in. And mashkon. Mashkon raises a complex set of questions on its own. So I'll talk about these last few sections on the beginning of Thursday. Then we're going to talk about the conceptual apparatus between the distinction between economic use of all these dinim versus more private law rights-based views. And that's going to lead us into the discussion of the Lichtenstein article and the Hochfeld article about how to understand rights and duties that underlie all of these concepts in Bav Metzia. So that's the plan. The plan for Thursday is we're going to finish up this overview, economic versus rights-based views, and then rights and duties and the Lichtenstein article. Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, you're cut off to everyone.